One of the more confounding and enduring challenges in education is the persistent achievement gap between black and white students. Generally speaking, black students underperform compared to their white counterparts. One of the long-standing explanations is that black students associate academic effort and success with, quote, acting white, and therefore they devalue learning. Our guest Angel Harris is challenging that notion with his new book. It's called Kids Don't Want to Fail, Oppositional Culture, and the Black-White Achievement Gap. He's an assistant professor of sociology and African American studies at Princeton University and joins us from their studios. And Angel Harris, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Were you a good student? I thought I would start.
No, I was not.
You were not.
No, I was not. No.
And why were you not? Why were you not a good student?
Well, growing up, I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and I was raised by my grandparents, and they weren't well educated. My grandmother had an eighth grade education, and my grandfather had a fourth grade education. So their goal for me was to be safe, stay away from drugs, and graduate high school. And so when I was in high school, in a class of 242 students, I actually graduated. My class rank was 217.
Oh, wow.
And so so I was really toward the bottom of the class. And I wasn't going to go to college. I actually wanted to go to Hillman, which was a fictitious college on The Cosby Show. I didn't know it was fictitious at the time.
Really?
Yeah, and I'd never heard of schools such as Rutgers or Arizona State or Washington. You know, these were states. I knew about Brooklyn College because I lived in Brooklyn, and I knew about NYU because Theo Huxtable went to NYU. And so, The Cosby Show.
Right.
And so college wasn't on the radar for me, and I just had a friend in high school who had some aunts that were really pushing me to go to college, and they, you know, gave me some applications to complete, and I completed them, and I got into Grambling State, which was the only school that accepted me. And they drove me 24 hours straight to Grambling, Louisiana. And it was the first time I left Brooklyn, I mean New York. It was the first time I left New York to go to northern rural Louisiana. And so they drove me 24 hours, dropped me off, and turned back around, and they went back to New York. And so I was dropped off at Grambling.
And were you ready for college level work?
Well, I was. What happened in college was during my first course, it was a psychology class, and the professor gave an example in the class that completely changed my relationship with education. He said, if a child is misbehaving in class, if a child's misbehaving in a playground, that's what it was. He says, you can turn to someone and say, Johnny's misbehaving. Or you can say, in the past hour, Johnny has kicked four kids, slapped five, and punched three. Mm. And that changed my life. Because from then on, what he did was he explained a notion of empiricism. It was not necessarily just saying that Johnny was bad, but describing what you saw and then letting others arrive at their own conclusion of whether or not that's bad and how bad that is. And so for a period after that, every conversation I have with someone, I would always say, what do you mean? I wanted them to define exactly what they meant. But that changed my relationship with learning and education. From then on, I was always looking to define things that were being said, to specify, to get the empirical essence of what was being discussed. And so that little example changed things for me.
And I can see where your interest then in the achievement gap, where that comes from. But interestingly, you are joining us from Princeton University, where you are a professor. So clearly you went from, you know, what, being almost at the bottom of your high school class to one of the more prestigious or most prestigious universities in the country.
Yeah, it's an unlikely story. It definitely suggests what's possible. It may not be probable, but it definitely suggests what's possible. And so the cautionary tale there is that if you're looking at a student in high school who's in the bottom 10% of his class, you never know who you're looking at or what that person can accomplish.
And let me just say that I was also near the bottom of my graduating class as well. So you and I have several things in common here. But let me get you, though, to respond to this notion. And it's a pretty pretty enduring belief system that for a lot of black students, they don't succeed in school because they don't value learning, because they see it as acting white. Is that wrong?
It is wrong. It is wrong. What people have to understand is that, are there some black students who will accuse others of acting white? The answer is yes, right? However, what proportion of black students do that? And it's a small proportion of black students that do this. And so the more relevant question is whether or not we're observing a general phenomenon that exists among children. So, for example, across racial groups, is there a general phenomenon for a disdain for nerds, you know, or geeks? Typically, we're all familiar with this notion that kids who are considered to be nerds or geeky are usually picked on in school, or they're usually talked about in a negative way. So children are going to do this. And does this happen among blacks? Sure, it does. However, what my research suggests is that 17% of black kids attribute academic success with acting white. That means that 83% do not. And so it's an overstatement to suggest that this is a reason for the achievement gap.
But why do you think this belief has persisted, and how do you think it affects a classroom if you have a teacher who might believe this?
Well, it's persisted because the gap has persisted. And so, you know, the gap has been around since the mid-1960s, it's been tracked nationally. And it did decline during the 70s and 80s, but that decline stopped somewhere in the early 90s. And so the fact that the gap persists, people then start to say, okay, well, what are the reasons why? What are the reasons why it continues to persist? We live in, you know, the land of opportunity. You can be anything you want to be. Why is it that a group continues to occupy the lower segment of the socioeconomic strata, and why do, you know, certain kids continue to underperform in school? And so the natural explanation that comes to mind is, well, perhaps they don't want to learn. Perhaps they are purposefully trying to fail. And what this does then is teachers who then believe this, it's one thing to go in a classroom thinking, well, a certain group of kids don't want to learn. So, you know, versus going in thinking, well, it's not so much that they don't want to learn, but it could be some other factors. And so that mindset is different depending upon which set of beliefs one holds.
Well, in fact,
going into the classroom.
And I'm holding your book here, the title, Kids Don't Want to Fail. And as you say, when a student enters, let's say, first grade or kindergarten, first grade, generally speaking, kids want to do well in school. This is a big moment in their life.
Yes, that's correct. And you know, what I find is, well, you know, what I talk about in the book is that in general, you know, blacks enter school with less skill sets than whites. But when you account for social class, and what I mean by that, when I say social scientists use the word that we control for things.
Mm-hmm.
And so what that means is, say you walk into a classroom and boys are doing better than girls on some exam, and you say, well, let's control for seating arrangement because most of the boys are sitting toward the front. Well, that means you randomize seating so that it's the same average distance from the board for boys and girls. If you retest them and the gap disappears, then you can say, oh, it's because of seating arrangement. We've controlled. So when you control for that, it should show up that the gap disappears. So I just wanted to give some context.
Sure.
As to what I mean when I say account. Essentially, when you I'm sorry, what was the question?
Well, you know, let me frame it another way, because one of the things that you say in the book is that, and again, we're speaking in broad generalizations here, but that generally speaking, black kids entering school do not have the same skill set, or even perhaps even the readiness or preparedness to start some of this academic work.
Yes, but when you, that's true. But what some studies show is that when you account for social class background factors, mm-hmm. such as parents' education, family income, wealth, you find that the gap in reading disappears, and there's a slight gap in math, but 80% of it is accounted for by social class background differences between blacks and whites. But then the gap begins to widen as kids matriculate from first grade on through the school system. And so the gap widens, you know, once they enter the school system.
But so taking this child, starting school, would you say then it's poverty more than race that affects how they are able to learn?
It's a combination of things. I mean, there's definitely a disadvantage associated with being socioeconomically disadvantaged. But there's also the perception of certain groups that can have an impact on how teachers approach teaching and how they approach certain students or students from certain groups. And so those things also play a part.
I remember interviewing someone a couple of years ago about poor parents. And again, we're speaking very broadly here. I want to make sure our listeners understand that. But that poor parents talked less to their children than more middle-class parents. I don't think it had anything to do with race in particular. And if they did talk to their children, they were more likely to give orders or to yell at them than to actually have a conversation. I don't know if your research has looked at that, but the issue it raises is again this preparedness for school, and does a young child that literally doesn't have the same vocabulary as another young child, are they at a disadvantage under those circumstances?
Well, certainly, and that's there's some work that shows that parenting is structured by social class background, that essentially parents from middle class backgrounds tend to practice what's known as concerted cultivation. And this comes from the work of Annette LaRose, sociologist at Penn. But, you know, also parents who are working class tend to practice facilitation of natural growth. And so what that means is that there are more directives. There's not as much conversation occurring. And so this definitely plays a part in the preparedness kids enter school with. You know, when you account for class background in the first grade, the gap is as small as it is. You know, it's just very small. And then it starts to widen over time.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. And again, Angel Harris is our guest today on the show. He's an assistant professor of sociology and African-American studies at Princeton University. And he's the author of a new book that we're talking about. It's called Kids Don't Want to Fail: Oppositional Culture and the Black-White Achievement Gap. This gap has narrowed and widened over time. It does persist, and it raises a whole host of questions about what is going on in the classroom, about parenting, and about the wider culture as well. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Also, open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. What do you think explains this gap, and what can be done about it? 1-888-477-WHY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Wistar Institute is proud to support WHYY-FM. I'm Dr. Russell Kaufman, president of the Wistar Institute, a world leader in biomedical research right here in Philadelphia. Today at Wistar, scientists can explore our entire set of genes to answer the question, what causes cancer? This research guides us to design individual therapies for different types of cancer. The Wistar Institute, today's discoveries, tomorrow's cures, online at wistar.org.
Coming of Age presents Boomer Vision. What's next in your life? Options for redefining retirement. Tuesday, September 27th at 6:30 at the Hamilton Public Media Commons at WHYY. Join the conversation about next steps in your life with an extraordinary panel who will share strategies about transitioning and ways to contribute in your community, whether working or volunteering. Boomer Vision. What's next in your life? Options for redefining retirement. 215-351-0511 or whyy.org/wider horizons.
Lancaster City Arts is proud to support WHYY. Lancaster City Arts, 125 art venues, all within one walkable community. From galleries, art studios, museums, and an art college, to music, poetry, dance, photography, professional theater, and symphony, it's an opportunity to experience something different in an art scene that's quite unexpected itself. Lancaster City Arts. The journey starts online at lancasterarts.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Our guest was part of a panel that was organized this summer on Martha's Vineyard by Professor Henry Louis Gates and the W.E.B. Du Bois Institute for African and African American Research. And it was a panel looking at the state of black education. And that's what we're talking about today on Radio Times. His book looks at this black-white achievement gap and offers a new explanation and perspective on this very important issue. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. So as you were saying, Angel, that students generally begin school, you know, pretty much on the same level, although I'm sure some kids have more advantages than others. But as time goes on, this gap widens. What is going on? What explains that?
Well, it's tough to say. I mean, there are a lot of factors. What comes to mind is there's a long line of literature that shows that teacher perceptions of students definitely are influential. So, for example, there's a study that shows that if you had four students, one black child, a white child, were told to enact what could be considered to be black body movements, black body mechanics, the way of talking, way of dress, and a black and white child will also pair to enact mainstream or European type behaviors, physical movements, and they were video recorded doing normal things throughout the course of the day in school. And these videos were shown to teachers, and the teachers were asked to rate the students in terms of academic ability, behavioral problems, and the likely need for special education. And what they found was that the teachers rated the black and white student pair that enacted the black body movements and things like that more negatively on all three factors than the black and white pair that enacted the European body mechanics. And what this suggests is that this may not be due to racism, but it certainly suggests that there is a negative association that teachers attribute to the ways of being that typically describe black students.
So I'm trying to imagine. So maybe the black students don't look like they're particularly interested in what's going on, or have a bored look. I'm trying to understand how, you know, what black body language looks like compared to white body language in a classroom.
Yes. Well, I don't know if it's. I don't know if you can describe it in those terms, in terms of looking bored or not. But it's the best example I can give you is when you. And this is an extreme example, but it conveys a point. When you look at the comedic routines of black comedians, such as Chris Rock or Eddie Murphy, you know, there's usually some part in the routine where they start to poke fun at white people, and they start to act and walk and talk the way they perceive white people to behave, and it's an extreme example, but there are differences in behavioral patterns, and they may not be related to looking bored or anything like that, but you know these differences certainly play a role in how teachers perceive children,
and maybe in almost a subliminal way.
Yes, certainly. I mean, the teachers may not be aware that this bias exists, but there are numerous studies that show that teachers tend to be biased against black students in subtle ways. And again, they may not be aware of these biases that they hold.
Is it different for female students compared to male students?
It is in the sciences. There are achievement gaps along gender lines, particularly in math. And you can go to any college campus and go to the engineering school, and you'll find a huge gender imbalance where you find mostly males and few women. And so, again, this could be due to the fact that women may perceive that there's some bias against women in math, and there's some research that suggests that students pick up on this. And students who perceive that there's a negative stereotype about the group that they belong to within a particular domain, say math or achievement, that has a negative consequence for their academic achievement. This is otherwise known as stereotype threat. And so, you know, women are aware of you know, the shortage of women in engineering and the reputation that women do poorly in math. And so studies show that this can have adverse consequences on their achievement in math.
What about the role of the parents? And we've done untold numbers of shows on Radio Times about education and about schools, and talked to people from just about all perspectives. And everybody talks about the key role that parents play in their child's success. Did you factor that in when looking at this achievement gap?
Yes, parent. Well, in this particular book, I accounted for family background, and that's defined as parents' education and parents' income and whether they're married or not, and so those factors like that. But I didn't specifically look at parenting. But I am in the process of I have a forthcoming book on the issue of parental involvement, and what I generally find is that it's an unpopular answer, but parental involvement is in many ways over the effects of it for achievement are overstated. I'm not saying it doesn't have an effect. I'm just saying that it doesn't have as strong of an effect as people think it does.
But I'm thinking of those teachers who have called into the show to say, you know, when we have a parent-teacher, school night, or I try to get a parent into the school to talk about what's going on with their child. And again, I'm speaking broadly here, but oftentimes in minority schools or even poor schools, you don't get that same kind of parental involvement that you might in a suburban school.
Well, yeah, and certainly you find, I find differences in parental involvement when parental involvement is measured as having to do with the school, in other words, interacting with the school, teachers, principals. But I find very little differences in parental involvement at home by race. And so essentially I'm finding that blacks and Latinos tend to be just as involved as whites at home. But at school, they're not as involved when it comes to talking to the teacher, talking to the principal, PTA, and things like that. And so you do find this difference. But the whole notion of parental involvement being important assumes that if you involve parents, this is going to close the gap. And that assumes that parents know how to be involved in a way that leads to positive results and achievement. And that's a big assumption.
Well, interesting you say that, because I'm looking at the Huffington Post. Actually, you were quoted in here. Essentially, when black parents get involved, they are more likely to be negative and punitive, and that doesn't help the teacher get through to the child. Is that what you're finding?
Yes, and so one of the chapters in that book, what I do is I look at how parents respond to poor performance, and I use national data, and I find that there were a number of responses that parents can have to poor performance, such as talk to the teacher, talk to the child, encourage the child, punish the child, and I sorted these measures of parental involvement into two different categories: punitive and non-punitive. And what I found is I found racial differences in parental involvement with regard to responding to poor performance. I found that black parents are more likely to respond using punitive responses to poor performance. White parents are more likely to use non-punitive responses. When I looked at how these things influence achievement, I found that punitive responses lead to declines in reading and math, and non-punitive lead to increases in reading and math. So essentially, black parents are doing more of what hurts and less of what helps, inadvertently, of course, because they are responding to poor performance It's just that the buttons that they're pushing, their buttons of action that they're pushing are ones that lead to declines. And so that's why I say, if you say, do you want all parents involved? I always say, well, let's not assume that everything they do is going to work.
And that's,
you have to question,
And I appreciate you saying that. And let me just quickly reintroduce you. And I do want to get some callers in on the conversation. We're talking with Angel Harris today on Radio Times. He's an assistant professor of sociology and African American studies at Princeton University, joining us from the Broadcast Center at Princeton. And he's got a new book. It's called Kids Don't Want to Fail: Oppositional Culture and the Black-White Achievement Gap. And when it comes to education, an achievement gap, no matter who is experiencing it, is a challenge, not just for the student and their family and the school, but also for society as a whole. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And Angel, I was reading that by the age of 17, the average black student is 4 years behind the average white student, which is, I have to say, pretty shocking. But I also wonder whether it explains the high dropout rate in a city like Philadelphia, where about 40% of kids drop out of school. Some do go back and get a GED, but nonetheless, that statistic is one that means it's harder to get a job, and that leads to, you know, obviously higher rates of unemployment and possible, you know, behavioral risks as well. Is that how you see it?
Absolutely, and this is an important point, that on average, black 12th graders are graduating high school with the same skill sets that whites had in the eighth grade. Mm. The reason why this is important is because if you think about this, you say, okay, well, when they were in the eighth grade, were they functioning with fifth grade skill sets? And when they were in the fifth grade, were they functioning with second grade skill sets? What this does is you say, okay, if you ask a child who's in the eighth grade to go through an eighth grade curriculum with fifth grade skill sets, that's going to be incredibly difficult for that child. You may imagine the child behaving in ways that, you know, frustration. They're being asked to do this, and it's expected that they do this. So you'll see frustration, and you'll start to see behaviors that you can say, this looks oppositional. This child looks like they're resisting learning. When in actuality, you're seeing normal patterns of behavior associated with frustration. Right. This is what, you know, when people on the golf course and they can't hit the ball straight, people throw the golf club.
That's right.
Get frustrated. And so these behaviors are seen as oppositional. But what we have to understand is that most children know that schooling is important. They know that, look, I'm better off with schooling than without. The issue is whether or not they have the skill sets to go through what they're being asked to go through. And what's happening with black students is that they do not.
Well, this sounds, though, then like an argument for an enormous investment in early education and those early years in schools, just to make sure that all kids are going to have the kind of skills that they're going to need in eighth grade or 12th grade or beyond.
Absolutely. The gap starts to widen from the time students during the time they're in first grade, and it begins to widen, and so you can imagine that students are set on different trajectories, with black and Latino students on a lower upward trajectory than white students, and so you carry that forward, and this is the achievement gap that we measure, and so I guess the whole point of the book is that this gap precedes any oppositional culture that's attributed to students, to black students.
Let me get some callers in on the conversation. And it looks like we have Dan from Center City, Philadelphia, joining us. And Dan, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, I can. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you. It seems to me that there's kind of a catastrophic elephant in the room, except people are mentioning it sometimes. But the fact that in our system, public education is funded locally. So that if you are living in a poor district, most likely you're going to an underfunded school, which I think is going to have a hard time attracting high-achieving teachers who could probably get paid much better somewhere else. And it seems to me that that's a giant factor in people, you know, who come from lower-income backgrounds having a lower success in education, and I was hoping maybe the guest could say what he knows about that.
Well, I appreciate the call, Dan, to Radio Times. And Angel Harris, your thoughts?
Well, yeah, school funding is definitely an issue, and it's one that has been brought up to explain the gap. The problem with that explanation is that it accounts for a portion of the gap. And so, again, when I say account, I mean if you equalize on that, on this factor, in this case school funding, the gap still exists. We see this in suburban school districts, such as Princeton. There's an achievement, as a black-white achievement gap. We see this in Shaker Heights, Ohio. You can go into most districts in America, affluent districts, you'll find an achievement gap. And so the school funding argument, sure, it accounts for some of it. In other words, the gap is slightly smaller in affluent districts and suburban areas, but there still is a gap. And so, you know, those districts give us a window into what the world would look like if school funding were equalized for all kids. And we still see a gap.
Well, which is so interesting to me and troublesome, I have to say, on top of that. I mean, is it about then what is going on in the classroom? Is it sort of a larger pervasive culture in the school? If everyone is essentially middle class and you still have an achievement gap, seems to me that that becomes even more confounding.
Well, yes, but you... In many ways, I think you know, race is an important factor. There are some studies that show that as the percentage of black students in a school increases, the number of highly qualified teachers decreases. And so essentially, you know, there was a study done in North Carolina in which the researcher was, there was a busing program in North Carolina, a Charlotte Mecklenburg school district, and the busing program was intended to provide racial diversity in the school district. And when the busing program ended, what you saw was an influx of black students to their neighborhood schools. And this was a perfect opportunity to examine what happens when you have an influx of black students in their neighborhood schools. What happens to the teachers? And what the researcher found was that teachers, high quality teachers, exited those schools.
Really?
Yes.
Looking for a different kind of student, a different kind of school experience.
Well. They exited those schools for schools with a lower proportion of black students. Mm. And so that's a part of the problem as well, is that, you know, race is an important component here. And, you know, teachers respond to race in ways that can lead to negative results.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. And again, Angel Harris is our guest today on the show, assistant professor of sociology and African American studies at Princeton University, author of Kids Don't Want to Fail, Oppositional Culture and the Black-White Achievement Gap. We have just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. What can be done to close that gap? Give us a call, 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY Camp Hill Special School with day and residential options is a community committed to the care and education of children ages 4 through 21 with mild to severe developmental disabilities. Camp Hill's curriculum includes music, art, drama, the sciences, life and social skills development, animal husbandry, and horticulture. Hosting an open house at their Chester County campus on October 15th. Details at camphillspecialschool.org.
On the next Fresh Air, where the idea for the show Breaking Bad came from. We'll talk to Vince Gilligan. He's the show's executive producer. And we'll also hear from Aaron Paul, whose character has evolved into one tough drug dealer. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
next Voices in the Family, the story of a young Iraqi woman whose life was threatened by extremists for working as a translator with the American forces.
There were bullets in the letters, and they were in my name, and my brother's name, and my cousin's.
A veteran who refused to forget her.
One of our teammates wasn't coming home, and that was Alia.
And a dedicated lawyer who brought her to this country.
I would email her and say, Alia, don't give up.
That's Voices in the Family, today at noon here on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are talking about the achievement gap, a serious problem. It impacts the country in profound ways. One estimate found that it costs the U.S. trillions of dollars in lost potential and increased services. Students of color still lag behind white students, even though reforms have been instituted to narrow or even erase that gap. We're talking about what explains this persistent educational gap and what can be done to address it. And again, our guest is Angel Harris, assistant professor at Princeton University, author of a book called Kids Don't Want to Fail. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I have to give a shout out to our engineer, Kevin, because he wanted me to ask you, Angel, what though about, let's say, a young single mom who has a couple of kids, and she had them when she's, you know, 13, 14, 15, 16 years old. Is she capable of helping her children do well in school?
It's tough to say. I mean, maybe not. It depends on a lot of factors. But what you have to think about is that a person who is 30 and has their first child may also be incapable of preparing their child for school. And so it's a tough question to answer.
But and again, I don't want to, you know, paint anybody one way or the other. But I'm just thinking of myself at that age, and myself as a, you know, 32-year-old parent. You know, what a different person I was, and frankly, just how hard it must be for young single parents to raise children.
Well, certainly, I mean that may play a role, for certainly, but. At the same time, it depends on the characteristics of that parent. You can have a single mother who is college educated. You can have a child whose mom is an attorney but is divorced. Mm. And so there are other factors involved as well.
But I'm just thinking about that teen mom, you know, that young mom. And that's just how hard it is for a 14-year-old to raise a child.
Well, absolutely. But I'm not sure how much of the problem can we attribute to 14-year-old moms. So in other words, I don't think that a large proportion of the achievement gap could be attributed to the fact that blacks are having children at age 14, 15, or 16. And so that may play a role for a very small proportion of black students. But I don't think that that's a big enough population to account for the achievement gap.
Let me see what looks like Janet from Tacony has to say. And Janet, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for picking me.
Sure.
I really want to speak to the expectation thing. I had the opportunity to work for a year and a half, or 2.5 years, in a Philadelphia high school.
Mm-hmm.
And I was personally able to witness the effect that expectation can have. And part of it is due to the fact that nobody knows what's going on in the other classrooms. So I got to see one group of kids in an 8th grade English class performing at an amazing level. Their teacher had high expectations. Their behavior was excellent in the class. They were writing essays that were college level. Their vocabulary was excellent. Their grammar was perfect. The very next year, they went down the hall to a new English teacher who expected nothing of them. Their idea of writing, of teaching the kids how to write an essay, was to have them copy paragraphs out of magazines because they didn't think that they could expect more than that.
Well, Janet, let me take your
and
point.
And I saw these same kids, you know, they thought this was a lark.
No,
it was fine for them. They didn't have to do any work and could skate through the class.
I hear you. I'm going to let you take care of your dog and give Angel Harris a chance to respond to that. And this is an example about expectations.
I think that the caller brings us closer to where the real problem is. And it is a problem of expectations, but there is also teaching or the model of education that we currently employ. And that's what needs to be examined, I think, more critically. And so I'll give you a quick example. If I create a program to help people quit smoking and 90% of the men who take my program quit smoking, but only 10% of the women quit smoking. Well, there's something about the program that is biased against women. Well, now let's switch smoking to education. Here's a program, education, and we find that a smaller proportion of black students are succeeding. So there's something systematically biased about this program. And so the question is, what is it? Is there something about the our whole notion or model of education delivery that needs to be reexamined because it's disadvantaging or it's biased against not just blacks, but it's also biased against blacks and Latinos as well. And so the caller was hinting at that when she mentioned that what the teacher was doing in one classroom versus the other. She framed it in terms of expectations, but there was also a difference in the teaching method that she discussed.
Well, and it raises questions about, you know, public schools, curriculum, vouchers, charter schools, religious schools, private schools, and you know, what is the best model that can help these students at risk?
Well, it's tough to say. I think that we, in general, speaking in general terms, educators, I don't think we respect the fact that people view information very differently. And so here at Princeton, I teach a statistics course. It's a very fun class. And
really?
I'm joking. You know, people have a lot of anxiety about statistics.
Yeah, no, I remember. Yes, myself included. No, go ahead, Angel.
And so what usually happens in that class is that I'll give, you know, I'll be going over technique, and there are going to be some faces in the class that, you know, they got it and they're nodding and they're ready to move on. But there are going to be some other people who have puzzled looks on their face. And so I then have to go to a second example. And that'll clear it up for some, but there's still others who didn't get it. And sometimes I have to dig into the third and fourth example. Because even though everyone in the classroom is looking at the same piece of information, their life experiences lead them to be oriented toward that piece of information in a different way. And so by virtue of if you and I are watching a movie, by virtue of you being by virtue of someone being a white female, they're going to see certain nuances within the film that an Asian male might not pick up. And so I think that in the classroom, you have a lot of different views of the world, and in education, we sort of privilege one general view, and we don't take into account the fact that people come to information looking at it with a different set of eyes.
But is that calling for a curriculum that's based on some of these racial differences?
Not necessarily. I think it's more. Maybe not a curriculum, but maybe a method of knowledge delivery that accounts for the fact that not everyone sees the world the same way. And so it may fall along racial lines, but I think it also falls along gender lines. I think it falls along, class lines. And so when anyone who teaches has experienced where you teach something and some kids get it, and then sometimes you have to teach it a different way, and then other people get it. And I think that we have to do more of that. We have to respect the fact that there's diversity in how people see the same piece of information.
Let me get, looks like Christina from Southwest to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Christina, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was really excited about this topic, being a biracial woman. My my mom is black and my dad is white, and I grew up in a predominantly white suburb of Philadelphia, Westchester. And I have found that as a child and then now as an adult in my professional life, that acting white or acting black is perceived differently, and I get a different reaction based on the inflection of my tone or my voice and certain words that I may use if I'm being... I've found that it's perceived to be more professional to use larger words, to have a very crisp inflection, and that I do use that in my business life, that if I'm speaking to a white person that sounds as if they're from a certain educational background, I'll use a certain tone of voice. And if I'm speaking with someone who sounds like they're from a in quotes lesser educational background, be they white, black, or Asian, international, then I may use a different type of vernacular, maybe a simpler way of talking, and then also just my tone will change. And I've perfected that in my professional life and really kind of use it to be like a chameleon, but I can see that would create, in terms of education, a problem with students who are still figuring themselves out, trying to, figure out who they are in the world. And, I've always thought of myself as being biracial. I was raised to think of myself as being just as much white as I am black and just as much black as I am white. However, some of my, co-workers and fellow students and growing up were raised to think, well, you're half black, so you're going to act black, and this is who you are. And so I think
Christina,
as a student growing up...
Yeah, let me take your point, only because it's a really good one, especially I always think people that are biracial get to see the world, Angel Harris, in a way that other people don't. But I'd be curious what you say in response to her call.
Well, yeah, what she's describing is known as code switching, and it's something that is pretty well known to people of color who are well educated or who are upwardly mobile in terms of socioeconomic status. You know, the further up you go in education and in terms of occupational prestige, there's this notion that one must know how to code switch. And I'm speaking again in general terms.
Sure.
And so it's something that, they're almost two languages that one must have. And it's easier to navigate or to employ these things when you're older and the more education one has. But it's much tougher to do this if you're a fifth grader or a fourth grader, when you haven't had enough experience with the mainstream professional world to develop these ways of speaking and talking and behaving and so forth.
And being bilingual or trilingual. Christina, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Eugene from Germantown has to say. Eugene, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello, Marty.
Hi.
Your topic is interesting. I'm a tutor in the Philadelphia area.
Mm-hmm.
I tutor children that go to parochial school and public schools. And I find that the children, and not all the children, but a lot of children in the public schools, aren't allowed to bring textbooks home. Mm. And I think that's, that creates part of the achievement gap. I think there's an art to using a textbook, and if you're not allowed to bring the books home and navigate through the textbooks, I think you're at a disadvantage.
Well, that's very interesting, Eugene. Let me see what Angel Harris has to say. What are your thoughts, Angel?
Well, certainly. There are certain skills that one picks up from having to navigate the textbook. Those things play a part in your interaction with education. The same way that when we talked earlier about parental involvement, and there are some parental involvement styles that allows a child to reason through their argument. If they want to do something, the parent has a discussion with them as opposed to giving them directives. And again, there's a skill that comes along with verbal jousting and things like that. And so I think the textbook is similar in that way, in that you have to sort of learn how to synthesize a lot of material, condense material, become comfortable with just flipping back and forth and finding information. And I think that definitely plays a role. And so there are a lot of little things like that that all contribute to the larger problem.
That was Eugene. Thank you for calling into Radio Times. We're almost out of time here. Angel, achievement gap or education gap has narrowed at times. It's expanded at other times. It clearly is a persistent problem. Are you optimistic that we have the tools going ahead to address this problem?
I think that I think the problem can be addressed. I think it must be addressed, particularly if you consider that by 2045 or 2040, 50% of the population is going to be comprised by black and brown people. And you can't have half your population walking around with eighth grade skill sets. There's no way that doesn't affect everyone. And so I think it's a huge crisis that must be addressed. But I also think it's a problem that is really deep, and in general, most people do not respect this problem. The projections suggest that the gap in reading is going to close in about 6 decades, given the current rate of decline, and the gap in math is going to close in about 10 decades, again, given the current rate of decline. When I hear people say that we're going to close this gap within the next few years, mm-hmm. within the next 4 years or things like that, I always hear someone who doesn't respect the problem. It's like walking into an oncologist's office and saying, hey, where's the cure for cancer? I want it next week. And I think once we respect the problem and we're able to realize that we have to really think critically about what we're doing, then we can sort of move toward a solution.
Well, on that note, Angel Harris, thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. The book is called Kids Don't Want to Fail, Oppositional Culture and the Black-White Achievement Gap. And he joined us from the Broadcast Center at Princeton University, where he is an assistant professor. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show, and it's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.